You're listening to the Humans of DevOps podcast, a podcast focused on advancing the humans of DevOps through skills, knowledge, ideas, and learning, or the SKIL framework.
If we have a connection to the customer, to the fact that we're competing for business, you know, if we have that connection, then energy flows in. I mean, energy is this intangible thing, but it's very present. You can see a team that's energized versus a team that's not.
Hey everyone, it's Jason Baum, Director of Member Experience at DevOps Institute, and this is the Humans of DevOps podcast. Welcome back. Hope you had a great week. Last week, I hope you listened to our episode. We discussed VR tech, so you'll definitely want to go back and listen if you haven't. We talked all about the metaverse, whether it will play a role in the future of remote work. Here's a surprise hint, I do. We're going to continue the conversation centered around remote work on today's episode, but today we'll be focusing on silos. Look, whether we're on-site, hybrid, remote, teams and departments tend to work in silos. It's not a new concept. In fact, it's quite natural when silos pop up. Often you'll see a team working and communicating very well with each other, but then not as effective with other teams. There's where the silos come in. We've been aware of this issue for a long time, and in some ways, we've created methods to avoid working in silos when in the same office space. But it's definitely harder when we're working remote, whether we're cities, states, or even countries apart. But we have the pleasure today of speaking to my guest, Brendan O'Reilly, a DevOps specialist who co-founded his company Dacia in 2004 and most recently led its transformation as a DevOps training and solutions business. An experienced technology leader running tech startups since 1990, Brendan is an agile coach and lean yellow belt. He is a DevOps Institute ambassador and published a book in 2020 titled One Fat, that's with two A's, One Feature at a Time, to help organizations overcome their older ways of working and engage customers in a process of ongoing value realization. Brendan, welcome to the Humans of DevOps podcast.
Hey, Jason, thanks a million for having me along. I'm looking forward to this. Hopefully we'll have a good fun day. And actually, I must listen to your last episode because just before we came on, we were having a chat about VR. And I've actually delivered some lectures in VR recently and had a whale of a time. The really interesting part happened after the lecture, which happened in a lecture theater, and we went in to have a coffee, and there was a virtual coffee machine, and that was when all the students came up and interacted with me when it was less formal, so to speak. So I also believe that VR is the future. Yeah,
you know what's so different about VR is, like, and you're describing the networking component. That does not lend itself as authentically, I guess is the right word, in Zoom, because you don't have the ability to, like, tap someone on the shoulder and interrupt their conversation. Something as simple as that we have taken for granted, but is embedded in us, I guess, in long-term networking, for example, or just randomly bumping into someone, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard to know how it's going to pan out, but the ability, as you say, to go and shake somebody's hand, for example, in a virtual world creates a different form of connection, and sit down and have a coffee, even though you are actually sipping the coffee, it creates this atmosphere where it's just a bit more relaxed, I guess.
There's haptic feedback, there's the sound travels around, you know, wherever someone's speaking, you hear it over to the left or to the right, the spatial audio. It's very cool. So check out last week's episode for those listening, and Brendan, please check it out. And I'm sure we're going to do more on the topic. And I do think it plays a little bit into our conversation today on silos. I was a communication major, and it was beaten into me that there is not such communication. There are so many different variations of communication, the types of communication. And then there is effective communication. There's no such thing as more communication. There is effective communication or ineffective noise, right? And I think that two plays a little bit into the conversation today on about silos, and I talked about it in my lead up. But why don't we just start right at the beginning? Why are silos bad, and how do they even come up?
Yeah, so why are they bad and why do they? Okay, so generally speaking, they're bad because there's a loss of productivity associated with having roles like classically the project manager who kind of traverses groups of SMEs, subject matter experts. So one individual is tasked with, you know, pulling it together and sharing things in documents. And of course, things go missing and tasks don't get aligned properly, as compared with the alternative, which is to have people collaborating, be it virtually, be it in a meeting space, where there isn't anyone directing the conversation, but that the group is to some extent self-managing, they're self-empowered, and tasks are directed between one another rather than through an intermediary. So there's a kind of a general loss of productivity through silos. It's not to say, by the way, that all silos are bad all the time. Okay, so there are situations where, you know, by virtue of needing, in say, for example, a bank, you need to have Chinese walls for the guys running risk. They actually have to be separated out from the guys in the day-to-day running of the business. But in general terms, they're bad. I mean, I think we're probably all familiar with, and if we're not, then Conway's Law is a good reference point here. So going back to, the start of when manufacturing, you know, big style manufacturing, likes of Henry Ford, they started out with this idea that we'll break a task down to component parts and we'll have people specialize in those parts. And that was the origination of the silo, the specialist task. And then the accountants, when they came in on top of that, they set up a chart of accounts. And Conway's Law says, well, okay, if we have that chart of accounts and we have, you know, manufacturing and we have supply and purchasing, well, then we'll have separate accounts for those people, separate office spaces, separate silos. And they become rigid. And the software systems then tend to mirror those. So the flow of data tends to go from the procurement system, which is standalone, to the accounting system. And we have, connections between them.
Yeah, because silos, you have multiple silos, right? You have silos of teams and you have silos of data. And you can have so many different silos within a company.
Yeah, and classically in IT, you've had, you know, silos of test, silos of dev, silos of analysis. So you have these teams of people who literally threw the work over the wall to one another with the project manager kind of hovering above them. When you look at a modern DevOps team, it's a team that has the resources to get code into production, ideally one feature at a time, right? To reference the book. Because when you're doing it one feature at a time, you can very distinctly and clearly see the value you get from that unique feature, as opposed to the 10 features if you release all 10 together. So having a team that can interact with one another for the express purpose and the common purpose of getting a feature into production, that tends to be, and it is, the most productive way for software to be delivered. But it's not easy to get there because, especially if teams have been working in those silos for quite some time, they become somewhat institutionalized to that way of working. And I've worked with one of the clients that I worked with was an insurance company. And I remember the lady who headed up the business analysis team kind of being horrified that, you know, she couldn't produce a 300 page set of requirements that sounded heavy when it hit the desk. You know, it had to be, no, we just want actually what we're going to build next week, just actually 2 pages. And if you could draw some pictures, that would really help. And it really was a challenge. And I understood that, you know, the lady had been working with a team of 15 people producing. And in fact, some of her bonus system was around having, you know, producing these documents that the customer would sign off. And the customer was really impressed when the document was big and heavy. Not sure they ever read it, but, you know. And the other point about it was, of course, by the time they came around to delivering everything in that book, some of it was no longer needed, which is really the waste. So they're building features, but the opportunity in the market has gone by. Where when we work collaboratively and outside of those silos, well, we're automatically attuned to that. So our product owner is checking, do we still need this? Hey, we just deployed it. Nobody used it. Do we really need it? you know, and that gives rise to insights that wouldn't otherwise arise until somewhat later if you're not building one feature at a time.
So there's you've triggered a lot of things in my head.
Sorry.
So no, it's good. So now I want to kind of review it and see if I'm wrong or right. But the first thing that I think of, I love the one feature at a time, by the way. I think that concept is great. I think many times we think several features down the line and we get lost in future rather than today, right? That's it can get overwhelming, it can get complex. We talked about that on this podcast a while ago with Mark Peters. And I think we referenced, maybe it was me, I referenced What About Bob and Richard Dreyfuss's Baby Steps. I don't know if you're familiar with the concept, but it's, you know, it's pretty popular. I mean, the movie came out, I think, in the 80s, but I think it still holds true, that concept of baby steps, you know, one step at a time, very similar to one feature at a time concept. The other thing is, you know, when you have group collaboration, I guess, I think people believe that's the right way to go about it. But they don't know how, because who owns it is like still the it's still thought about. Oh, well, okay, great. We can all talk about it. We can all ideate. But at the end of the day, who owns it? Right? Whose responsibility is tied to it?
So for me, the word product will be in the job title, as in product owner, product manager, as to whether that person is permanently in the team or has a representative in the team. That's kind of another point. But I think, you know, even though we're going to release one feature at a time, we do have to have a vision for the product. And that becomes a cohesive force for the team, not just the team building features 1 to 4, but also the team building features 4 to 8 and so forth. So that person is the person who is, in my opinion, one of the most pivotal roles. They're able to engage engineers, customers, competitors, and prioritize the work. Okay, what are we going to build? Then the engineers build it. Then we see what it looks like. We get the feedback and we start again. But it's done very collaboratively. So let me give you an example. You know, it could be the case that the product owner really wants to try and build features 1 and 2. But when the engineers look at how the code is structured, they kind of point out that, hey, if we're going to change feature 2, make more sense to do feature 3 within this sprint or this iteration, and we'll come to feature 1 at a later stage. So we kind of collaborate so as to make sure that we're at our most productive. I think in terms of the ideation, let me talk about something that is really dear to my heart. Everybody can have a good idea. Absolutely everybody. Steve Jobs talked about, you know, in bad companies, it's the people who shout loudest. In good companies, it's the people with the really good ideas that flow to the top. And I think companies should put in place a continuous innovation process, a bounty for ideas that work. So whether it's on your team or whether it's the CEO or the guy who just joined the company as an intern, they're all capable of having a good idea. And we need our backlogs, you know, to be full of ideas, and we need our product owner, whoever it is, to prioritize those. I mean, let me give you an amazing stat. Booking.com has at any moment in time 1,000 experiments underway, and in an average year will run 30,000. Now, Jason, here's a challenge to you. What percentage of those pan out to be good ideas that actually add value? Have a guess.
My guess is maybe 1 to 2%.
Ah, you're a little bit out. It's actually closer to 10. Okay, but that means that like 90%.
Yeah.
Don't work, but that doesn't stop them, right? Because the ones that work out are the ones that yield them, a competitive advantage. And it is a very fast moving world. So you know those companies like Booking.com, they have these innovation backlogs, and that comes from having a collaborative spirit that transcends silos. I digress. We can talk about innovation another day. We're here to talk about silos.
I still think actually 10% is actually pretty high to me because, you know, I don't know. I don't pretend to believe that 90% of my ideas are well, or that 10% of my ideas are good. I actually tend to think that most of them are bad. And then the ones that are good, hopefully they're really good, you know, and I guess it's that same concept. But we kind of touched on initiating that breakdown of silos. I, you know, one of my passions right now and that I've really been diving into is the customer experience side of things. And I see there's a big connection to employee experience too. So silos very much interest me. What is the role of feedback in breaking down silos?
Yeah, so feedback is the breakfast of champions. Can't remember who told me that. I know as a customer.
That's a great quote.
Yeah, I can't remember who originated. You'll have to Google that afterwards. Without feedback, we're like in a car traveling across the desert. The lights are on. It's dark. All the windows are blanked out, and we're just driving around aimlessly, and we're going to get lost. So feedback tells us whether we're actually succeeding or not in our purpose. You know, so it's by far the most important, and the sooner you get it, the better, right? And there's a whole bunch of really good tools out there to help you get it in real time. So, you know, tools like New Relic and Launch Darkly. And these tools, you know, allow you to put one feature into one domain, for example, a geographic domain, see how it's working. And if it's working, then roll it out. And if not, deprecate the feature and start again. So there's no reason not to be constantly running these A/B tests and getting your feedback, particularly in a B2C environment. Obviously, in a sort of B2B world or in internal applications, it's more difficult, right? It's not as straightforward as I've just described. Just to touch on the initiation, I think, you know, one of the things that so much depends on context. So I work with a range of organizations from startup to growth to, you know, full-scale multinational corporations. And generally speaking, the siloing kind of creeps in as they go from growth stage to multinational. That's when up until that point, people are tasked with doing multiple things. And so the silos are less obvious. But then as you want to grow and become a little bit better at things, you tend to want to silo out the work. When you get into the MNC world, it can be full on silos. So one of the things that really works there is things like book clubs and hackathons, you know, to get people to start to meet one another again and to, hey, I didn't know you worked here and you're the guy that was on that email trail. That kind of conversation really helps. And you know, books about organizations like that particular reference I made to booking.com is a Harvard Business Review paper. You know, you could read it in 20 minutes. You share it with your colleagues, you invite them for a brown bag lunch, maybe bring in a vendor. We do a lot of this kind of stuff. We'll come in and host a lunch.
Today's episode of the Humans of DevOps podcast is sponsored by Collide. Collide is an endpoint security solution that sends your employees important and timely security recommendations for their Linux, Mac, and Windows devices right inside Slack. Collide is perfect for organizations that care deeply about compliance and security, but don't want to get there by locking down devices to the point where they become unusable. Instead of frustrating your employees, Collide educates them about security and device management while directing them to fix important problems. You can try Collide with all its features on an unlimited number of devices free for 14 days. No credit card required. Visit collide.com/HODP to sign up today. That's Collide, KOLIDE.com/HODP. Enter your email when prompted to receive your free Collide gift bundle after trial activation. From the employee side, I guess I still have some questions about employee feedback when it pertains to it. And then also relating it to a remote environment. What are some of the unique challenges that a remote environment present with silos?
So here's the thing, right? I think it's a really good point. People, when that feedback comes to those that are kind of new on the job or inexperienced or perhaps really proud about getting a feature out and the feedback comes that we have to deprecate the feature, that's a bit of a crushing moment for the person who has to hear it, okay? And when it's remote, it's even more difficult because whereas, you know, a manager could, a product owner could go and sit beside the individual and say, hey, I know it didn't work out, but it's good because now we're going to avoid a cul-de-sac. We're going to have another go. We're going to try going this way. We're still attempting to achieve this with the product. It's just that particular route didn't work out. When that happens remotely, it doesn't have the ability to just put your hand on the guy's back or the lady's back and say, hey, good job. You know, not everything can work out well. The software was well built. It's just the feature isn't required by users. My bad. You know, it's my bad that as a product owner, I picked that wrong feature. So I think it's really difficult to get that sincerity across in a kind of a, you know, ways around that are when you, when you have an all hands on the Zoom to say, hey, listen, particular thank to engineer A or B for their hard work. And we've learned from that. And again, it's a case of try and try again until we get it right, you know. It can be crushing if you're the engineer that whose feature is just now cast to one side.
It's interesting. I mean, the all hands on Zoom. I mean, the VR standups, that was what the team last week at Modern was doing. They were doing it, I don't know if they were doing it once a day. I think they were doing once a day, like an hour with their development team in VR. And it was a different experience. I think it got them excited. The CEO was telling me, Jonathan Schneider, it was just different. It got them, I think they were a little more engaged maybe. They could collaborate more. So that was one example from last week that was shared with me.
Yeah, so let me just add to that. That's really interesting. So the university where I did the lecture, it's IT Carlow. They're just a region in Ireland. And they are working on the production of a virtual DevOps simulation. Okay, so they've created a workspace. It's kind of interesting. So I'm diverting there. So you might need to get me back on track. But they've created this workspace, a scene, where they put the devs downstairs and the tests upstairs. So you have to trudge up the stairs to get your test results and back down again. And then, you know, guess what? We move the two side by side. We put a Kanban board up and we can improve. But it was really interesting when we brought people in to do the CNA, right? You know, and then we sat them down and we said, so let's do a retrospective here. What do you think? What would work? What should we improve? And, you know, nobody, you have to really say, well, we could move the furniture. Oh, right. Yeah. Okay. Well, why don't we bring that?
I think sometimes it's generating excitement, right? Again, I think sometimes when you're sitting in the same space, when we're in an office, we do get up and we do collaborate and we do have those coffee minutes and we do have the trip to the lunchroom and we do have times when we're just not sitting and working, coding, whatever we're doing. We are generally, for the most part, collaborative people. Even when we're in silos, I think we are still collaborative amongst, like I was saying in the intro, the teams and hopefully more in DevOps. I don't know if that's true. I think that's a piece that's just generally missing is potentially the excitement that sometimes you get from others.
I think you've touched on something there, which is that sometimes when people are in silos, it can turn into a, we all do the same thing, we all have the same conversation. And if we're not in the right frame of mind, that can turn into what we call a moan fest, right?
You know?
So whereas if we have a connection to the customer or to the fact that we're competing for business or what, you know, if we have that connection, then energy flows in. I mean, energy is this in intangible thing, but it's very present. You can see a team that's energized versus a team that's not. You know, the team that's energized works through lunch. You get a lot of discretionary effort at weekends. We've got to go live, you know, and we're happening. The team that's not energized is trying to figure out how to knock off early and avoid responsibility and so forth. So yeah, that kind of you're right. Excitement is energy. It's an essential element of a collaborative team.
You know, when you could feel it, when someone's new. When someone's new, they come in, they're energized, they have new ideas, they're throwing things out. Hey, you might have talked about it as a team 500 times. They don't know, but they're going to throw it out and they're excited about it. Maybe that 500th time and you heard it from an excited person, maybe all of a sudden things start, you know, moving and clicking up there and they usually bring excitement to the rest of the team. I wonder if feedback plays a role into that because maybe there are ways that we can generate excitement that doesn't just have to be someone new to a team. But yeah, I don't know. I'm just kind of riffing on that.
Yeah, well, I think you know, a good scrum master, or you know, the person that runs the retrospective, will generally try to elicit from all team members, but particularly the new team members. Actually, I must tell you an interesting story about an airline that I worked with, a really interesting one. You know, a good scrum master will try to elicit ideas and feedback. So we'll obviously do the retro and we'll talk about what we could have done better. But then we'll try to say, well, who's had experience of this elsewhere and what has happened elsewhere? Now, one particular client, a team member left, went away, worked for another organization and came back about 9 months later. And the retro suddenly got really interesting because that person came back with a bunch of new ideas and things that they had experienced over that 9 month period, which they were able to bring into the team. Now, within that organization, they also have another role, which is an agile coach, which is somebody who transcends the teams. So they drop into the retros for the about 16, 17 dev teams, our delivery teams, to give them the correct title, because they are all tasked with putting code into prod. So, you know, the agile coach has to take the best ideas from one and make sure that they transcend. So it becomes a kind of a very standard way of working for the teams. So that if people need to move between teams, it'll feel like, hey, I'm not just moved to another planet. I'm just moved next door to the team that's working on features, different features, the one that I'm on. So that that feedback, I would say, is also, let's incorporate shared experience there. So wherever it may have come from, and wherever it may come from, it could come from books, training courses, YouTubes. Like, I love people to be curious in teams, you know. Can we find a way to think about a problem? Can we get a bit of time out? Can you know, between sprints, could we get maybe a half a day to just spend some time researching new areas? And if those areas seem to have merit, could we get a little bit of time out of production to explore them further, get some funding, and perhaps we can build something or create something of value that could be shared across the entire team, all teams?
Yeah, it's interesting. So those who listen to the podcast know that I am a sports fan, and American football in particular. And what you're describing to me, I'm thinking about it. And something I heard about Coach Bill Belichick is that he trains his coaches to fill multiple roles. So it's very standard. You'll have like a wide receiver coach, a quarterback's coach, a running back, and they fill those roles. But he moves them around from year to year to build well-rounded coaches so that they could fill in whatever spot they need to be in. And I mean, the idea is to make them just better, well-rounded, thinking holistically, thinking, you know, and gosh, that could be applied. That's exactly what you're talking about, right?
Yeah. And I mean, I bet you, when they bring their fresh mind, if they're a defensive coach, and they bring their that mindset to a new area, they'll ask just lots of dumb questions. There is no such thing. You know, there's just lots of really good questions that you haven't thought of before. And actually, I coach soccer. I think you call it soccer, right? As opposed to football. Football.
Yeah,
is
we call it soccer. I don't know. It doesn't make any sense, but that's what we do.
So we call it, I coach a bit of soccer and had that experience of working with a guy who was very offense oriented and I was defense oriented, and it worked well. And then we did have you heard of the Wright brothers, how they used to work? It was Orville and, have you heard this story?
I know the Wright brothers, but.
Yeah. So here's what they used to do, right? This is really interesting. So one of them would have an idea, okay? And in the morning, they would argue over this idea. So in the morning, one of them would argue for, and the other guy would argue against. And these would sometimes turn into, these would be shouting matches. Okay? Then they would go to lunch and they'd come back and then they would invert.
Argue the opposite.
The opposite, right? Yeah. So, you know, that concept, I found that worked really well with my colleague when he was the offensive coach. I was the defensive coach. So we used to take turns at just saying, okay, that match, let's review it. Okay, you do the offense review, I'll do the defense review. And we'll.
It's a great exercise because it does make you think outside potentially your comfort zone and think in the other person's shoes. I mean, that's a great exercise. And I'm sure the quality of the product could just improve based on your knowledge of
Yeah, and I just want to, I don't know how it worked in football, but we do that with our team. So with when we'd finish the match, we do the review, 15 guys all waiting to go for their beer, but nobody's going anywhere until we've had that conversation. and then we just pick out the two or three things that we want to improve.
Yeah, no, I mean, Coach Belichick, I mean, I don't know how many other coaches, maybe other coaches do it. I'm sure they single him out because he wins a lot, you know. You know, he'll take a defensive line coach and the next year he'll be an offensive line coach, you know. So like, and throwing them into the fire, but it seems to work.
Yeah, and I think it's a route to management as well. I mean, I work with, I coach some of the, you know, CTOs. And when he's got, when we're looking at developing people and talent and so forth, you really want them, especially if they come in and they're just working in, say, a dev role, but they could be working in an SRE role, or they could be working in test. You really want them to have that all-round experience so that when they are leaders, they actually have walked the walk, and they can you know, understand and appreciate the perspective of all of the individuals and their teams. And that helps with, you know, well, I mean, we're not talking about silos now, we're talking about, you know, individual performance improvements that we can look for and realistically expect as well.
But is that one of, because I was just about to ask you, when we're fostering cross silo collaboration, you know, I think one thing that has to be kept in mind is making it not seem artificial or unnatural. Is self-improvement, you know, improving your own capabilities and understandings and becoming more well-rounded on everything else, isn't that one way to do it, make you more aware of what other teams are doing, potentially what someone else in a different role is doing? Is that one way to do that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the individual within any team wants to be able to add value, ideally around their specialist skill. But equally, they want to raise the game for the others in the team. So they want to be able to help other people be more productive. I mean, I'll give you an example. You know, this is very typical, but again, one of my clients, when they analyze the code that actually works, the code that goes into production, there's probably a small number of engineers that actually do that. And there's a large number of engineers that write kind of code that needs to be then fixed up after the event. I mean, what has to happen next is the engineers that aren't getting their code into prod, they need to be helped, they need to be coached. The best way for them to do that is to look at how the senior engineer has actually edited and changed the code, and to do that openly, right? So to have a review, this code is better now because we restructured how we designed it and built it and so forth. And then the engineer that's on the learning side of things gets better and grows and hopefully goes on to become that senior engineer. It's a normal kind of a path. Same for tests, same for all of the other disciplines. So yeah, and then when they get better at doing those things, they can move on to doing other things. It's also a real tension, because of course if you've got really good engineers that are producing really high quality code, you know, do you really want them to be managers? And very often, by the way, those individuals become managers and say, hey, this isn't for me, I just want to get back to writing software that works, you know. So but it's all part of the fun and games. But definitely in terms of breaking down the silos and making it easier to move people between teams, those kinds of behaviors, that openness, that transparency, that culture, you know. It's interesting. One of the companies that I do a lot of work with, that frightens people off. If you're not an engineer that's comfortable to have your code explored and reviewed, peer reviewed, you're not going to fit in. You know, they have an expression in that particular customer account: if you last 6 days, you'll last 6 years. But if on the seventh day you're feeling really uncomfortable, then yeah, good luck. It doesn't work. And it does happen. You know, people just won't stay.
This might be an odd example, and forgive me, because again, so if you listen to this podcast, you know, I have a 4-year-old daughter, and everything in my life right now is surrounded, like everything goes back to parenting and her. And an interesting example of this is the company Disney. Walt Disney has a team of artists, right? Now they're digital artists, but they are artists. And, you know, whether you're coding, whether you're drawing, you know, they're working on collaborative teams. And then they have peer reviews. We were watching the documentary about the making of Frozen, their biggest franchise hit, right? And they have several peer reviews for just one cell. Right? One cell of the movie gets seen by like 15 people. They sit, they talk about it. What could they do differently? They'll have, you know, the directors will be there. The producer will be there. They'll pick it apart, make them go back to the drawing board, redo it, come back, present it again. And it is just constantly analyzed, but by a team collaboratively. And they produce, they take those same designers and or those same artists, and they'll be working on another feature film while they're working on that. And they're just doing these different scenes. And so they're just dropping them, picking them up, moving them on to something, you know, but then collaboratively coming back and talking about holistically how it fits into that. And I thought, wow, that's kind of what we're talking about a little bit. And I feel like Disney does it so well because they produce so much content in a year.
So it's really interesting. My youngest son is now 24 and he's an animator.
Okay. So you know a little bit about this.
Yeah. Well, oddly enough. Yeah. So when he first started to work as an animator, about 2 or 3 years ago now, we started talking about how work was organized. And guess what? A lot of the core concepts for software engineers originated out of Disney. This idea of a storyboard and visualization of work, and they use Jira and all, you know. And so he was only working there in this company for a very short period of time. And he started to talk to me like, and this release and that sprint. And I was like, oh, wait a minute, this kid, is he's right up there with it. So the thought that occurred to me when you were speaking, though, was kind of, there's a real tension here between the context switching that's required to go from a piece of work I'm really intensely focused on now to kind of getting my head out of that and going and looking at another piece of work. Now, in software terms, what we try to do is we automate how we build the software. So we have this idea of continuously integrating the code that all of the engineers are working on, so that we can, the objective is to kind of break the build, right? Now, historically, that was a bad thing. People used to have a fear of breaking the build, but actually breaking the build is a good thing because we need to know now, not in 6 weeks' time when we have to do a complete context switch to get back and look at what was broken. I'm now going to ask my son. So when you're asked to do the peer review on something that's nothing to do with what you're currently working on, is that a bit of a head melt? Is it a good switch off or something? Because in general, when an engineer is asked to work on something until it works, that's the system, right? We don't really want to have to come back to that in 6 weeks' time and fix it, because now we've got, they reckon each context switch is about an 11% overhead. That's for the first one. Wow. Right, for the first context switch. The second is 33%. Okay, so now we've lost a third of a working day if we have to switch context twice, and after that it goes exponential. It's just like I'm getting nothing done because I'm just moving between tasks, you know.
But I wonder, to bring it back to something we had talked about earlier, I wonder if that keeps the energy level up, or is it frustrating? I don't know, because, you know, maybe it keeps it fresh, you're not constantly on the same thing. I don't know if you're pulling your hair out because of an issue and you can just jump off it for a day, work on something else. I don't know. Maybe it does to see, you know, that's maybe a positive take on it.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, sometimes a change can be as good as a rest, you know, right. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, certainly if you're rat holing on whatever the problem is and you're kind of iterating on a piece of code with some engineers and you're just getting nowhere, there is a point. It's like, I don't know if you do crosswords or Sudoku, sleep on it. And in the morning, things seem to be clearer.
It'll come to you in 2 in the morning, right?
Sometimes, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and look, some of these practices, to bring it back to remote, it does make it difficult to do some of this peer review and to collaborate and, you know, sometimes even just looking at the same thing at the same time with someone else. If you're not in the same room, that can make it difficult. So,
okay, but let me give you some upside. So I did a call with 3 or 4 CTOs, and I wrote a blog about it, actually. I think I'm going to share it with you, the remote working learnings. So there's a couple of upsides. So a number of the CTOs that I spoke with were quite happy to have their engineers work remote because there was less what they call drive-by shootings. Are you familiar with that expression?
Not in this context.
Okay, so engineer sitting at his desk and a customer one of the business guys bypasses all of the procedure in terms of the sprint and all that kind of thing, just drives by and says, hey, you wouldn't just give this 10 minutes and fix this for me. And, you know, some engineer gets kind of shot as they drive by, right? So less of that. more opportunity for focus. Another big upside was people who tended to be quieter at reviews. In the virtual, in the Zoom world, you know, the person controlling the Zoom could mute everybody and ask the quiet guy to speak up, okay? And for the first time, they were being heard in that sense. So there was some positives there. And I think the other one that was very interesting was writing like an Amazonian. I don't know if you've seen much.
I have, yeah. Yes, I have seen that.
So people were, you know, put on training courses in one instance to take the waffle out and put the fact in. So
I love that. Yeah. Well, my gosh, Brendan, we could talk about this topic, I think, for another 2 hours easily. There's a lot to say here. I hope you'll come back. I think we should review this again. I think this is a topic that's going to continue to evolve, certainly. I mean, it always has, it always will. The more work environments we have, the more different, more roles that pop up and are created, the more I think we'll feed the silos, but then also break them down. So I think there's a lot we can kind of talk about. So I hope someday you will come back and continue to share with us.
That would be a pleasure. This is the most fun I've had in a podcast in a long time.
Oh, awesome. Okay. So I did warn you about this. Sometimes I warn our guests, sometimes I don't, that we're going to ask a very personal question. So I hope you thought about it. Today, our closing question is going to be, if you could be remembered for one thing, what would that be?
That I died trying.
I love that.
So I think continuous improvement and continuous learning are, you know, they're just part of who we are. And as long as you have those things and you die trying, then yeah, you're, I'll go happily to my grave. If that's on the gravestone, that'll be it. I'll be happy with that.
I died trying. I think that is fantastic. I think that would be, I think anyone could just hope for that, right? That's great. Thank you so much, Brendan. It was an absolute pleasure having you on the podcast today.
Likewise. Take care, Jason.
And thank you for listening to this episode of the Humans of DevOps podcast. I'm going to end this episode the same way I always do, encouraging you to become a member of DevOps Institute to get access to even more great resources just like this one. Until next time, stay safe, stay healthy, and most of all, stay human. Live long and prosper.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Humans of DevOps podcast. Don't forget to join our global community to get access to even more great resources like this. Until next time, remember, you are part of something bigger than yourself. You belong.